Think testing. There we go.
Testing, testing. Hey. This is good. It's very formal here, very. Can you hear me in the second row, Vinny? Can you hear me?
Is this good? I can use that?
Yeah, that works great for me.
Okay.
Sure. Have you guys heard my Kuiper series?
What's that?
My Kuiper series? Have you heard it before? Oh, okay, that's what this is. So, just so you know. If you'd already heard it, I was going to say, yeah, you might want to go. Not that, you know. Okay, minute and a half? Okay. I just want to see what I said I was going to do. Testing, testing. Yeah. Okay. Okay, okay. So if I get muted during the feedback, just allow space. Okay, cool. All right. Here's what I sent you, I think.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Hugh Ross's Paradox class. It's really great to have everybody here in person and online. I want to thank Val Durham for all the goodies, the treats back there. It's one of the things that makes Paradox the fantastic class that it is. So welcome, everybody. For those who don't know about Paradox class, we talk about science and faith issues every Sunday, normally with Dr. Hugh Ross, who is in, he's working really hard, and he's sweating a lot. He's in Hawaii right now. So say a prayer for him that he can enjoy Hawaii speaking there. So we have a fantastic guest speaker this morning. Robert Cavolo, are you assistant pastor at the church?
Sure.
Okay. Robert Cavolo. Robert is pastor of theological formation here at Christ Church in Sierra Madre, and I'm going to read you a little bit from what I found out about him online. It's all good stuff. He says, Robert Cavolo is a cultural theologian residing in Los Angeles. He's served as a scholar at the Visual Faith Institute of Art and Architecture, on faculty at the Torrey Honors Institute, and currently directs the Center for Pastoral Residence, Christ Church at Sierra Madre. That's right here. When not theologizing on everyday practices, he enjoys mountain biking, surfing, canyoneering, and Mexican food. And I know that because we've had lunch. So, okay, and this morning, Robert is going to talk about the theologian Abraham Kuyper. And maybe you've never heard of him. So this is good if you haven't, because this is going to be really important. You're doing a four-part series?
That's right.
Okay. So week one, maybe you'll be doing this, but I'll introduce him too. The first week examines Kuyper's remarkable life. What was his upbringing, education, and conversion? What were his remarkable achievements as a pastor, a theologian, a journalist, an educator, and a politician? How long will you be speaking? How long will it go this morning, do you think?
About 30 minutes, I'm guessing.
Okay, so 30 minutes, and then we'll do some Q&A afterwards. And you're going to be here next week as well?
Yes.
And then I think there's a break in the schedule, and we pick it up in a little while.
Yes.
So
yes.
Please, everybody, welcome Robert Cavolo.
Variety of titles: theologian, pastor, professor, journalist, politician. In reality, Kuyper was really marked out particularly as an institution builder. He established a number of institutions, including a political party, a denomination, a university, a school movement, two papers. He was the editor of two papers and established a paper. And so Kuyper really believed in the power of institutions and the value of Christians investing in institution. Now, of course, secularism is not new. It's been around a long time. But as we approach Kuyper, what we're going to see is Kuyper had the capacity to think outside the box. Kuyper had the capacity to think about how secularism is afoot and why it's operating the way it does. And Kuyper also had this capacity to think cosmically about the gospel. Kuyper knew how to see how the gospel connects to all kinds of facets of our lives, including our intellectual lives. As I already said, Kuyper was an institution builder, and he built powerful institutions, churches and political parties and universities, schools and denominations, and even the press. But Kuyper also forged a new way during a period where there were very limited options. There were traditionalists who sought to move everything back in history, and then there were modernists who were embracing the secular impulse of the age. And Kuyper offered a third way, and that's what makes him so interesting. And I'm going to say this morning, Kuyper's third way of dealing with secularization is something that is prophetic for our own moment here at this time in this place. So, as was said, in the next four sessions, I am going to talk about Abraham Kuyper and how he teaches us how to engage a secular age. And so you know where we're going. Today is going to be one of those biographical background talks. I don't know if you like those biographical background talks. I love biographical background talks. I feel like you really get to know somebody when you know about their girlfriend in college and, you know, the kind of things that they wrestled with at a personal level. At the end of the day, all these philosophers, you know, like if you ever study Michel Foucault, Foucault was a crazy person. And when you realize and you read about his personal life, it really impacts your ability to see his philosophy the same way. Or like, Rousseau. Rousseau abandoned his children to orphanages, which was sure death during his time. And suddenly when you know that about him, it changes the way you see his philosophy. But when we learn about Abraham Kuyper, it's also going to impact the way that we see this man. So the first week is we're going to look at Kuyper's remarkable life, as Ross already said. Our next session, which is going to take place next week, we're going to explore Kuyper as a person who understood how to engage culture. What is culture? What are the various ways Christians can engage culture? And what are the theological resources we have as Christians as we engage culture? The third session, we're going to look at Kuyper, the Christian politician. Imagine that, a Christian politician, okay? Actually, not just a Christian politician, the only person in the history of the church, by my lights, that was ever a systematic theologian and the head of state. Put those two together, okay? And by the way, when you are actually at that level of politics, you have to determine policy. You have to work within the muddy details of what we're actually going to do to move forward in any given arena. How did Kuyper respond, and how did his Christian faith come to bear on the unique political ecology of the Netherlands? And then finally, our last week, we're going to look at Kuyper, the critic of modernism. The critic of modernism. And by that, I don't mean that Kuyper was against flush toilets and didn't want to ever be in a car. What I mean by that is that Kuyper, when he hears the word modernism, he actually is reading into that secularism. So Kuyper, when he says modernism, he means the way in which the secular age has rooted itself in the modern period. And we're going to draw lessons from him, and then we're going to move forward even a little farther to our own postmodern period and look at the way in which Kuyper's wisdom still speaks into our, maybe we'll say, late modern postmodern period. A lot of the use of modern there. But today we have the delightful job in front of us. It's not a job, it's a delightful enterprise of looking at Abraham Kuyper, the man, okay? The man, the myth, the legend, Kuyper. And he is quite a character. You always want to start with understanding somebody's parents, and so we're going to start there. This is Kuyper's parents. Here we go. Kuyper's father was of humble origins. He spoke and worked hard to learn English. Of course, Dutch was his native language. He had a shop in Amsterdam, and while he was working there, he practiced English all the time. And he finally got to the place where he could begin translating some minor English tracts. And this opened up a scholarship for him to study theology at Amsterdam and then Leiden. And he was an adherent of what was called the moderate Orthodox supernaturalist school. Basically, this was those whose adherents had a high regard for peace and tolerance, and they weren't known for dogmatic clarity. They weren't known for their doctrine being really clear, but they were kind souls. And he was to follow Kuyper's turn to orthodoxy when Kuyper finally does turn to orthodoxy, because we're going to find out Kuyper is one of these people, kind of like C.S. Lewis. C.S. Lewis starts off as an atheist for most of his young adult life, and then he flips. And Kuyper is going to be a similar thing. Kuyper is going to start off, and he's going to be a liberal theologian. He's going to get a PhD in theology and not believe in the resurrection of Jesus, think that the Bible is full of errors, and he's going to flip. A very unusual, usually it doesn't go that way. Usually when someone goes down that, you know, I'm going to start discrediting the Bible and down that kind of higher criticism path, we don't usually see them swimming back upstream and becoming a champion of orthodoxy. But Kuyper is one of those people. But Kuyper's father was this kind of like, you know, milquetoast, you know, was interested in theology, but was kind of fuzzy in his theological thinking. And even when Kuyper then becomes this great champion of orthodoxy, his dad kind of, you know, begrudgingly eventually adopts this kind of orthodox position. Seven of Kuyper's eight grandparents were born outside of the Netherlands. They were born in Latvia, in the Baltics, in Switzerland, in Germany. And Kuyper loved to go to Switzerland, where his grandmother was from. His grandmother was French-speaking, and Kuyper loved to go to Switzerland. Kuyper's mother was an accomplished French language teacher at a girls' boarding school, and they liked to speak back and forth in English and French, not Dutch, okay? So Kuyper now, think about this, Kuyper ends up growing up with Dutch, speaking English with his mom all the time, speaking French with his mom, and Kuyper also spoke German. So like most of these Europeans, that, you know, we as Americans, we travel abroad and suddenly we're shamed by the fact we only know one language. Kuyper understood four languages very well. And on top of that, Kuyper had Latin down pat. He used to write his postcards in Latin, okay? I don't know how many of you are writing postcards in Latin, but that's a surefire way to make sure no one else is reading your card except for whoever the erudite person on the other end of that postcard is who reads it. So this is Kuyper's father and his mother. And there you can see Jean Frederick Kuyper and Henriette Kuyper Huber. And there they are. Kuyper writes, "I never attended a public school or a Christian one. My father and mother taught me at home. Therefore, I owe them a great debt of gratitude. My mother was of Swiss origin and as a consequent, was fluent in French. Father had a good command of English, and both knew Dutch well. They also taught me arithmetic and writing so that I certainly was not behind others who did attend school." No, Kuyper was not behind. In fact, Kuyper was off the charts when it comes to genius, okay? He was a polymath, and you're going to see that as we unfold. So Kuyper ended up attending the University of Leiden. If you've been to the Netherlands, you have kind of a handful of, you know, good universities, Groningen up in the north, and you have the University of Amsterdam, and then you also have Leiden. And Leiden's typically considered the top university in the Netherlands. And actually, Kuyper's dad took a pastorate up in Leiden just so Kuyper could attend Leiden. Remember, this is a poor pastor's family, a milquetoast, you know, not too theologically clear pastor's family, right? So Kuyper goes to Leiden. And of course, we get to read all kinds of things because Kuyper wrote everything. We get to find out about how Kuyper is just like most teenagers in college, you know, most college students living at home. Kuyper doesn't like living at home with his parents. He writes, "On coming home yesterday afternoon, I found an invitation for a young couple's engagement party, which I could not decline. I had to be there at approximately 6 o'clock and didn't return home until 2:30 in the morning." Typical college student, right? "I had a really good time last night, proposed toasts galore, and, just imagine, recited a verse." So here he is, like, you know, drinking and reciting poetry at this party. "And, in short, I came home, recited a verse, saw a little comedy, drank nice claret." I'm sure lots of it. "And in short, I came home ringing the doorbell in high spirits, only to find, and yes, it was frightful, my old man in a nightcap glaring at me with a one-two friendly face, if you know what I mean. it was quite a nuisance for him to stay up so long in the cold, right? So, you know, we get this, like, I mean, how often do you get to find kind of like, you know, this great theologian who changes the world? He's like, you know, his interactions with his dad in college where he's out partying and his dad's just ticked at him that he has to wait up at night. So we get to read about his relationship with all kinds of people. And life at Leiden is, what should I say about it? You know, Kuyper studies the classics. He studies philosophy and theology and languages and literature. He was deeply educated and, as I said, fluent in Latin. He gave speeches in German. He wrote postcards in Latin and was fluent in French and English. And he even writes, check this out, put this into your computer. Kuyper writes his thesis, his senior thesis, which was about a 300-page document in Latin. Okay, those were the days, right? Those were the days. What are they teaching kids these days? So there's Kuyper as a student in 1860. He's kind of a dandy of sorts. You can see him there. He's got the sweet digs. And then you can also see there, it says, on 16th of July, 1855, Kuyper enrolled as a student in Leiden. Students who intended to study theology, Studis Theologiis Destinitiis, first had to take preliminary examinations in the arts, which included Greek, Latin, Dutch, Hebrew, and Hebraic antiquities. Examinations in mathematics were also required. That's interesting. On the 26th of June, 1857, Kuyper passed the examination with magna cum laude, and on 39th April, 1858, he became a Bachelor of Arts, summa cum laude. So there is Mr. Kuyper as a student. Now, something very important happened to Kuyper. And it was an academic competition. And this actually would set the course of Kuyper's life, okay? It was a competition, the Groningen competition. I'm gonna use that nice Dutch Groningen. I can't really spit as much as I should, but that Groningen, we say Groningen? No, it's Groningen competition. M. Davies, Kuyper's professor, tells Kuyper to enter this competition, and he decides he is going to write an academic paper on the doctrine of the church. And so Kuyper decides to do it on Elasco, which is a name that was very familiar back there. It was a Polish reformer, okay? And Elasco is a famous, he's written several things. So Kuyper begins looking for resources to write this paper, to enter this contest and to win it. And time is ticking. And he starts looking throughout Europe. Finally, he has somebody say when he's dejected, he's almost given up, he's almost going to pull himself out of this competition. I don't know if you ever like really tried hard to do something, and it's like a brick wall after a brick wall after a brick wall. Kuyper's trying to, he's trying to write this paper, and he's almost given up. And then finally he turns to somebody, they say, you know, there's a guy down the street. He's got a library. Why don't you ask him? And so Kuyper goes down there, and he finds the only extant copies of Lascaux's work that he could find in Europe. And it's like right down the street. And this ends up becoming the source for him to write this paper. He ends up winning the competition. He gets a gold medal. He gets money. It gives him the resources to go on to further doctoral dissertations. And it also gives him a focus, which is ecclesiology. Abraham Kuyper is known for cultural theology. He's known for teaching us how to engage culture, but his expertise on how to engage culture actually came out of him understanding what the church is and what the church's role is. But here's the most important thing. By the time Kuyper is writing this essay, Kuyper is, he's a very, what should we say, he really doubts all the fundamental doctrines of the Bible, okay? He's a liberal at this point. And by liberal, I mean in the technical sense of somebody that's thrown out all of the classic doctrines of the church. He doesn't believe in the virgin birth. He doesn't believe that Jesus Christ is the second person of the Trinity incarnate. He doesn't believe in the resurrection of Jesus. But when this happens, when he realizes after searching and coming to the end of his rope, then somebody says, why don't you check down at the end of the street? And he finds these academic resources. It rocks him. And he feels like God has put these in his hand. And in some ways, it rekindles this idea that God is at work in this world in our lives. And that doesn't work well with his kind of loosey-goose, quasi-deistic view of God. Like, how would I hold this kind of liberal deistic view of God that rejects anything supernatural when something so personal, so powerful has happened in my life, and it rocks him? And so it's the beginning of his conversion, even though there's going to be several steps to this man's conversion. It takes a long time to win over this liberal doctoral theology student. All right, so he's at Leiden, and he's at Leiden during the height of modernism. And modernism was a theological impulse that tried to eradicate anything supernatural in the Bible. You may have heard of the word, the term deconstructionism, okay? Or, I'm not looking for deconstructionism. I'm looking for, Bultmann's demythologizing. Demythologizing was a movement which said we got to go to the Bible and we need to rip out anything supernatural in the Bible, because that's part of the ancient mythology. And what's left, that is what's something we can lean on. And this was the world that Kuyper was in. This is the water he drank, all of this anti-supernatural demythologizing. And among the professors who lectured Kuyper, among the professors whose lectures Kuyper attended were the Old Testament scholar Abraham Kuenen, the theologian J.H. Schulten. By the way, you can see this picture. This is in the translation is sweat chamber, and this is where you get invited in when you defended your dissertation. And on the walls, I was in Leiden actually a few years back, and I took this picture. On the walls in the sweat chamber are all the great scholars that have been to Leiden. And so you can see all kinds of people in there that are famous. But there was a picture front and center of J.H. Schulten, which was one of Kuyper's scholars that he followed. And J.H. Schulten was a New Testament scholar, and this is what's famous about J.H. Schulten. J.H. Schulten, one time during the chapel at Leiden, gave a strong, long, impassioned argument that culminated in this declaration that for these reasons, we can be assured that Jesus Christ did not rise from the dead. And when he said that, professor of New Testament, Kuyper says, me and my friends stood up and we applauded it with crazed happiness that this man would give such a bold declaration, and we were so happy. This is Abraham Kuyper at Leiden. Think about that for a second. So this was the modernist movement, and the modernist movement, as I said, was anti-supernatural. It was deeply immersed in the Enlightenment, and the Enlightenment would say that there's only one way to know something. It's through reason and logic. Revelation is thrown out. So Kuyper is getting immersed in higher criticism of the Bible, and he says that during this time, I came to the academy a religious man, but after 1.5 years, my conviction had changed into the most absolute intellectual rationalism. Imagine studying theology as an anti-supernatural rationalist. Interesting, but they do it. Go to Harvard Divinity School, you'll see it in motion. So Kuyper later said, in the academic world, I had no defense against the powers of theological negation. I was unconverted at Leiden and proud to be unconverted. In other words, he had undone what little religious faith he had growing up in this milquetoast pastor's life, home. All right, well, let's move along. Everything wasn't negative at Leiden. There was this good news, Johanna Hendrika Shea. This was Kuyper's girlfriend and then fiance. And they have the most beautiful writing back and forth to each other, by the way. This is one of those things that's very touching. You know, if you like C.S. Lewis, it's really wonderful to see his relationship with Joy Davidson. So if you see this with Johanna Hendrika with Kuyper. In the summer of 1858, Kuyper met his future wife, Johanna Hendrika Shea, daughter of the Rotterdam stockbroker, you know. And so just so a little FYI, like back then, a stockbroker in terms of class would be below a pastor or a scholar. So Kuyper views her as below his class, all right? And so this is the dynamic in their relationship. And Kuyper is always seeking to help Johanna understand. And Kuyper's kind of arrogant. Like it's kind of offensive to read the way in which he kind of talks to her, like she doesn't know anything. And But she just receives it like, of course Kuiper should be instructing me. Here's this brilliant, you know. And Kuiper was brilliant, right? But it's really funny. And that's going to come back to bite him, by the way. Okay, I mentioned that on purpose. So, but Kuiper's girlfriend, and then becomes his fiance, Johanna, she knew Kuiper's aunt. And Kuiper's aunt brought her on a trip with her to Leiden in 1858. And she developed a friendship with Kuiper's aunt and then came to visit Kuiper often. And she was, word is that she looked very cute, according to Kuiper, in a dress, as Kuiper tells us, and according to reports. And Kuiper eventually fell in love with her, okay? So Joe, as she came to affectionately be called, was always being taught by Kuiper. Kuiper has her reading Erasmus, who also attended Leiden, by the way, you know, and Kuiper has her reading all the classics, and he needs to educate this poor daughter of a stockbroker who he has fallen in love with so that she can be up to speed. And this is God's comedy to the whole thing. He's giving her book after book after book to read to get her up to speed, and one time she gives him a book, and it's one of these silly popular romance novels, The Heir of Redcliffe, by the English novelist Charlotte Mary Yonge. And she belonged, in case you don't realize, she belonged to the Oxford movement and studied with John Keble, whose college I happen to have attended at Oxford. But she wrote the novel as an attempt to confront cynicism toward the church, okay? And so she is writing this novel dealing with cynicism towards the church. And Kuiper reads this novel, this popular novel in English. Remember, he's fluent in English. And it undoes Kuiper. I mean, it's hilarious. Here's Kuiper with all this serious stuff to give her, you know, and she's like, well, I really kind of like this romance novel, and gives it to Kuiper. And God used that novel. And by the way, God really did use the novel, because I've looked at that novel, I've read some of that novel. It's like, wow, I don't know what Kuiper saw in this thing. But Kuiper identified with a certain character in that novel who is arrogant. And then as the novel unfolds, God gets a hold of this arrogant character and just wakes him up. And by time Kuiper put down that novel, he fell to his knees. And this was his second conversion moment. He's not fully converted yet. He still doesn't believe in the Apostles' Creed, okay? But he falls to his knees and he confesses to God that he's an arrogant man and that he needs God's help. And so God is using Joe, his fiance, at that time. This is one of my favorite conversion stories, by the way, is Abraham Kuiper's conversion story, because it's long coming, right? So Kuiper graduates. He doesn't believe in the classic theological truths, the Apostles' Creed, you know, all that. But he has God stirring in his life. He had that thing where he found Alasco's work right down at the end of the street, and it seemed like God was in that. And then he realizes he has a hard heart. And then he becomes a pastor at this small church, okay? And as a pastor at this small church, Kuiper has problems. And the problems is that Kuiper's parishioners want him to preach the Bible. But Kuiper is a liberal theologian with a PhD in liberal theology, and Kuiper pretty soon realizes he has nothing to say. There's no good news to proclaim. There's no truth that we can stand on. And so Kuiper, and when he shows up in Beest, B-E-E-S-D, which, by the way, I came to find out was only like 15 minutes from where I stay typically when I go to the Netherlands. But when Kuiper was there, as soon as he shows up and he's not preaching the Bible, a good chunk of his parish stops attending. And he's like, what in the world? Where did they go? And this is to Kuiper's credit. And by the way, this is one of the marks of every good theologian. Kuiper doesn't write off the laity. He doesn't look down and say, well, what do they know? I've got a PhD. Kuiper goes and seeks out every single person that stopped attending his church. And he asks them, why are you not attending anymore? And they say, you know why? Because you're not preaching the Bible. This one woman who is a poor potato picker, okay? Young woman, very poor. She says, you don't preach about my Lord. And because you don't preach about our Lord, I'm not going to come listen to you. And in fact, this group, we've gotten together, And we're coming together on Sundays, and we're reading all the great Dutch classics. They're called the Puritans. She didn't even know the Puritans were English, okay? So she just assumed because she had translations in Dutch that they were Dutch, okay? But she's reading we're reading the Puritans, you know? But what amazed Calvin about these people, and even the people that stayed on in his church, is that they had a living faith. In fact, they had a living faith. And Calvin wasn't Kuyper wasn't stupid. He immediately recognized that they bought into the classic doctrines of the Reformation. Those great doctrines of discovery, justification by faith, right? That the word of God is something we can stand on. Those things that were discovered in the Reformation. Kuyper writes, Calvin, even though he lived 400 years ago, still existed. However misshapen in the mouths of these simple laborers who had hardly even heard of his name and yet had his theology. Calvin had taught these people centuries after his death in a foreign country in a remote and forgotten corner. These truths of the Reformation were living on in my church, in a small room with a flagstone floor, with a common laborer's mind. They still understood these great truths. For the riddle, there was only one solution. Calvin had established a church, and he had, by this consistent church structure, bestowed blessing and peace in properly disposed minds. Kuyper is sitting there saying, how is it that I'm trained in all the greatest modern liberal theology, and I've got nothing to say? And somebody that existed 400 years ago, who rediscovered central truths in the Reformation about God's word — Kuyper wouldn't see it that way, but truths about God's word and God's salvation by grace — how is it that his theology lives on? And he had to solve this dilemma. So Kuyper, and this happens all the time when you see people, you know, converting, you know, I'm thinking of theologians because I'm a theologian. But when I've seen theologians who are off track, inevitably at some point they become curious about classic Christianity. They start reading the patristics, or they start reading the theologians from the Reformation. Typically, you know, it's for the wrong reason. Like, I want to debunk it, or they're just like, what in the world? Why would people even believe this stuff? And that's what happens to Kuyper. Kuyper reads Calvin. And remember, Kuyper's in the Netherlands, so Calvin's the main name. If we were in Germany, it would have been Luther, right? That's the reformer that he's most acquainted with. So he reads Calvin, and it all begins to break out. Okay? And this is John the Baptist in Kuyper's life. This is Pietja. Pietja is a potato picker. And her claim to fame is she led one of the brightest theological minds to Christ as a potato picker. Does God love to use weak instruments? Do you need, I mean, can you imagine? Some of us feel like, I can't ever share the gospel. Can you imagine trying to share the gospel with somebody that can read the New Testament in Greek, who is so far beyond educated? Can you imagine having the boldness to do that and leading them to Christ? This woman is an inspiration, and we're going to meet her in heaven. Even when Dr. Kuyper had become a minister, she wanted nothing to do with him. This would just be another one of those half-grown, half-committed, half-baked, half-winged church wreckers. He was so strongly ethical. That means he just thought the Bible was there just for good rules. It taught us to be good people. Dr. Kuyper saw at once the power of conviction in this woman's simple faith that made him break with all the half-heartedness of his liberalism. So Kuyper starts meeting with her. And at first he's just curious. And over time, he starts finding out what she's reading. Over time, he starts reading it. And and as the story goes, we have time to get into it, but slowly but surely, he started talking less and listening more. And the Holy Spirit got a hold of Abraham Kuyper. Okay? There was, and this is the beginning of his third conversion and final conversion. There was one more really important thing. Dr. Allard Pearson, a well-known ethical minister, and that's what Kuyper would have identified with. I believe the Bible has good ethical rules for us to follow, but all that mythology and all that doctrine, who needs it? Just follow the golden rule, right? That's where Kuyper was at. Well, a hero of Kuyper's, Dr. Allard Pearson, a well-known ethical minister in Rotterdam, left the ministry right about this time. And in a pamphlet he wrote, Dr. Pearson in his last parish, Pearson explained that his decision to leave the ministry came from his increasing conviction that the church was now obsolete. It had done what it was meant to do in history and humanity, and now modernity could take it from there. And at that moment, Kuyper realized where theological liberalism was heading. it was the death of the church rather than the empowerment of it. Kuyper became the anti-Pearson. He, once he read that, when he was meeting with this potato picker, had a conversion. And he returned to orthodoxy, and he wanted in every way to come back to the classics of Christianity. If you ask me what kind of theologian I am a classic theologian. That means I think the Apostles' Creed got it right. That means I think that the fundamental doctrines that you read within the patristics and restated in the Reformation about God's simplicity and God's divinity and the power of God and that Jesus Christ is God in human flesh, I believe all that stuff. And Kuyper made his way back to that classic Christianity, the Christianity that he realized alone could actually address the issues of modernity. And so in April of 1867, Kuyper came out with his first church pamphlet as someone openly on the side of what was called the Orthodox or the classic movement of Christianity. And it's called What Must We Do? And Kuyper addresses the issues of church offices being elected by the members of the congregation rather than the liberal state imposing liberal pastors on the church. And in an age where churches were filled with godly lay people, but increasingly liberal clerics who were hired by the state, this is how Kuyper felt the church could move forward, is actually something called congregational polity, which we actually have at our church here at Christ Church, where the lay people, right, are given power to recognize who is godly among us, who is walking with the Lord, who understands the word of God. That's somebody that should be our leader. There's something really powerful about that form of polity. So Kuyper ends up immediately being a rock star for Orthodoxy. And so he's invited to Utrecht. And Utrecht is where the bishop's seat is. It's where the largest cathedral is in the Netherlands. And it also happens to be, by the way, kind of the center of the Orthodox movement. And so Kuyper moves from this small besed to actually Utrecht, where he is going to be the dominee, that's the Dutch word for like the minister, of the Utrecht Cathedral, as you can see it right there, the Domkerk. But when Kuyper gets there, and it's kind of like moving from like, you know, Kuyper goes to like, I don't know, the Bible Belt. Utrecht's like the Bible Belt, right? This is where it's safe to be an Orthodox theologian. But when Kuyper gets there, he's not satisfied. He says, but what did I find in Utrecht? Everywhere, petty sentiments, all the leading men locked up in the stronghold. Only think of a possible weak defenses, waiting for the first shot to be fired. And when it finally came, firing back as best they could, while the outer rings of the faith, in other words, outside of Utrecht and Amsterdam and Rotterdam, were being offered up to the enemy. No longer any ideal to strengthen the spirit and wrest from the enemy, not only theology and the church, but also social and political life. The whole situation repulsed me, so I decided to become a sniper. I decided to go on attack and threw grenade and grenade toward the opponents. Okay, listen to this language. Like, Kuyper's like, I'm not happy to have this cosh, you know, kind of posh job sitting around enjoying that I'm like the new dominee in like the Bible Belt. He's like, look at our country. It's going to hell in a handbasket. Look at what's happening in Amsterdam. Look at what's happening in Rotterdam. We need to not only think about how do we advance Orthodox theology, we need to, and not just within the church, we need to think how about we advance it in our politics, in our culture, in life, that all of life should be fleshed out with a Christian vision, worldview. Here you see the beginning of Kuyper's understanding of Christianity is not just a set of doctrines you subscribe to, but as an entire worldview that you hold on to. Okay, so Kuyper is not happy at Utrecht, a little too safe, a little too Bible Belt, so where does he go? He takes the post at Amsterdam, at the New Kerk. And there, Kuyper's powerful sermons and gifted intelligence get traction. This is a guy that can talk to secular people because he was a secular person. He came out of secularism. He came out of being a modernist that embraced all the tenets of secularism. By the way, this is always in church history, this is the person who is the most powerful. You know, it was because C.S. Lewis had entered Oxford as an atheist that he could talk to atheists. You know, it was because the Apostle Paul had been a Jew who had studied under Gamaliel that he could go to all the different Jewish settlements as he went around the Roman Empire and say, let me tell you about Judaism, and let me tell you why it points to Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus the Messiah. He knew it from the inside out. He could give an insider's critique. And this is Abraham Kuyper when he shows up in Amsterdam. And it wasn't long before Kuyper's reputation as a challenging and talented speaker spread rapidly through Amsterdam, and he began to address large and enthusiastic audiences, and that church got filled. That giant, the New Kirk got filled. It's, you know, the New Kirk, it was probably built in like 1700 or something, but anyways. And Kuyper regularly takes modernism to task. And in 1871, he wrote a speech called Modernism, Read Secularism. A Fata Morgana in the realm of Christianity. A Fata Morgana is Latin. It means a mirage, something that seems to promise something, but it's going to be empty. And Kuyper here is saying that when the church buys into all the newest secular tenets, the anti-supernaturalism, the higher criticism, she actually ends up, even though it looks appealing, looks majestic, looks entrancing, and it's actually going to leave you thirsty. So this is Kuyper in Amsterdam. Kuyper is not satisfied with being this powerful preacher that is, you know, leading people to Christ. He starts a newspaper, The Standard, and he begins mobilizing Christians that place through this newspaper their agenda at the front and center of national politics. By the way, daily newspapers were unheard of. This is the first daily newspaper in the Netherlands, okay? To this day, actually, there's a Christian newspaper that is the number two read newspaper in the Netherlands, okay? Probably because of Kuyper's influence. So he became the de facto emerging leader of a political party, which was underneath Groen van Prinster, who was, there was something called the Reveal, which was an evangelical awakening in Europe in the 18th century. And Groen was, he was an aristocrat who came to know Jesus. And then he was involved in politics. And so Kuyper gets together with Groen and says, we need a new political party. And it's called the Anti-Revolutionary Party, the ARP. The ARP, by the way, was in the Netherlands all the way up until, I think a few years ago, it actually just merged with another party. Not this current prime minister, but a couple prime ministers ago was actually of the party that Kuyper started. So this isn't just like dead political history. I mean, this is a force, actually it's still influencing the Netherlands. But Kuyper says, we need to start a new, he looks at the political landscape and he's like, I don't like our options. As Christians, we don't really fit in these categories. Let's start a new political party, the ARP, the Anti-Revolutionary Party. Why is it anti-revolutionary? What is the most secular revolution in world history? Any ideas? The French Revolution, and we're going to do a whole thing on that because many Americans don't realize how deeply secular the French Revolution was and anti-Christian. So Kuyper starts the French Revolutionary Party. Kuyper is a journalist. Kuyper heads to Parliament. He was the first pastor to be elected as a member of the Second Chamber of Parliament, which was pointed out in this caricature. By the way, because Kuyper was in politics, there's entire books with cartoons of him. Some of them are hilarious. A lot of them are not flattering, okay, because that's what you do with your political opponents. He was a strange figure in Parliament because he didn't really operate according to, should we call it the swamp? Like the way in which you were supposed to operate, okay? He's not a lawyer like most members of Parliament. So when he speaks, he's a pastor, and he just cuts to the point. And people are like, that's not how we do this around here. Like, what's this guy doing, all right? So he spoke without adhering to the traditional form. And his major opponent is this guy, Johannes Capine van de Koppel. It sounds like he was a Dutch-Italian. He's a leader of the liberals in the second chamber, an astute, provocative politician who saw parliamentary debates as sparring matches. And Kuyper led the School Act, which sought to privatize education. Let me just say what this was. Basically, it'd be the same thing as vouchers. So Kuyper said, look, if people get taxed and their money then goes to fund the state school, but the state school is pushing secularism, that is not equal. And what that really means is that Christian parents and Catholic parents and Jewish parents and anybody that doesn't want secularism pushed is going to end up paying twice, because they have to pay for the state education, which they won't send their kids to, and then the private education. So you're charging them twice. So Kuiper said, we need to have an open, the tax money for education needs to be available to all schools, no matter what their worldview. I got my PhD at a state-funded university underneath a godly, charismatic Dutchman, and he taught me classic theology at a state-sponsored school. This is because Abraham Kuiper said, we can rethink education. And to this day, if you are a Christian parent in the Netherlands and you want to send your kid to a Christian school, you don't pay more for that. That comes from the same tax dollars that other schools, whether they're Roman Catholic or secular or what has it, also draws from. By the way, America almost had the same system, but when the Roman Catholics came to our school systems, which were Protestant school systems, which we said the Lord's Prayer and we had the Ten Commandments, the Protestants said, oh no, this is a public school to the Catholics. If you want to have your people, you know, doing the rosary and praying to Mary, you need to start your own school and pay for it. We kind of shot ourselves in the foot on that moment. So Kuiper went and made sure that didn't happen in the Netherlands. All right, so, okay, I said a half hour, but I just love Kuiper. Kuiper forms the Free University, the FU. Okay, there's me. I graduated from the FU. There's me. That's the bust of Kuiper, which you can see right outside the main auditorium of the FU. And there's me in my doctoral defense. I'll just say right now, doctoral defenses in the Netherlands are the worst doctoral defenses because you can actually not get your doctorate. It's like a real defense. Typically at your defense, there's people that have voted against you that show up to the party and they want to take you down. Okay, so it's a lot of fun. But anyways, I'm an insider on this whole thing. So Kuiper started the Free University, which was meant to be a Christian university where you could think about everything in light of the Christian faith. Here's Kuiper at the inauguration of the Free University. And in his speech at the inauguration of the Free University, Kuiper says what is his most famous quote. And if there's one quote I want you to learn in this series, it's this one. There's not a square inch in the whole domain of our human existence over which Christ, who is sovereign over all, does not cry, mine. Christ created all things, and Christ came to redeem all things, and it all belongs to him, and he wants it. And when Kuiper gave this speech, he's talking about the fact that every single thing, there is no area of knowledge, there's no area of study, there's no line of thinking, there's nothing you can study in this world which does not correspond to Jesus, because Jesus created all things, and he came to redeem all things. How are we doing on time, Ross? Okay. We're almost done. Only a few more slides. Okay. So we'll talk more about that. Kuiper sought as a politician to address real public issues. Now, here's what I want to say about Kuiper, and we're going to have a whole thing on Kuiper the politician, but Kuiper doesn't fit within our categories. Okay? In our North American political ecology, it doesn't line up. We've got the left and we've got the right. You know, and if you're on the right, you know what that means, you subscribe to it. And if you're on the left, you know. Kuiper thinks, and this is why it's so healthy to read Kuiper. It's healthy to read Christians that are not a part of our cultural moment, because they can help us think outside the boxes that we are placed in. And the Social Congress on Reform Principles met in order to address the social question. Kuiper initiated this. And at the opening of the Social Congress in Amsterdam, Kuiper delivered a passionate speech calling for serious engagement with the issues of the working class and with poverty. Remember, Kuiper is around in the 19th century, where you have, I mean, this is right on the heels of the Industrial Revolution, where working conditions are terrible. You know, you have child labor, and you have the Industrial Revolution, which is so nasty. And so Kuiper says, as Christians, we can't turn a blind eye towards these things. So he rejects both socialism and liberalism. Liberalism is actually, we use that to mean like voting Democrat in our country, but liberalism actually means, like, socialism is where you think of everything in terms of the collective, and liberalism is where you think of everything in terms of the individual. And Kuyper says, we have to reject both these options. And he believed that the Christian philanthropy could not no longer offer a solution simply by itself. Kuyper argued for an architectonic structural social criticism founded on God's word. Only one thing is necessary. If the social question is to be real for you, you must realize the untenability of the present state of affairs, Kuyper said, and you must account for this unattainability, not by incidental causes, but by fault in the very foundation of our organization and our society. We're going to get more into this, okay, when we talk about Kuyper the politician. Kuyper is going to scramble all of our categories, and it's really healthy. And whether or not, I'm not trying to get you to agree with, I don't agree with everything on Kuyper. By the way, there's no theologian I've ever read that I agree with everything. Something would be wrong with you. You're just not reading deep enough, and you're not being a person with your own voice if you read somebody and you agree with everything. Okay, well, Dr. Ross, we agree with everything he says, but I'm just kidding. You know, we have to be thinkers as Christians, and God has given us our own minds and our own voice. But Kuyper is extremely interesting. Let's move forward to, we'll talk more about that. Kuyper is a scholar. Kuyper produced an unbelievable amount of work. I was tempted to bring in my the complete works of Abraham Kuyper's public theology, not his other kinds of theology. It's this big. I can't bring it here, okay? But the visible sign of that kind of wakes you up. Kuyper wrote every day something that was published. Can you imagine that? Think about that for a second. I mean, there might be a handful of days in his lifetime as an adult where he wrote something that was not published. Okay, he was the editor of two newspapers. He wrote all kinds of multi-volume things, books, theology. I mean, incredible. So he was a serious scholar. And then Kuyper traveled all over. What you see right here is, actually, it's a picture that's in our home. In that Dutch there is Om de Oudswoudse, which is, actually, this means on the old world. And when Kuyper lost the prime ministership in 1905, Kuyper dealt with depression. And Kuyper, when things didn't go well for Kuyper, he struggled with depression. I kind of similar. I have that kind of Kuyperian, like, when things fail, I like depressed for a little bit, like, oh my gosh. And so what Kuyper did is he traveled around the Mediterranean. He stopped off in Israel, and he went to Algeria, and he went to Eastern Europe. And as Kuyper went, he talked about Christianity's relationship to all these different places. Kuyper is one of the very first Christian scholars to give a genuine, deep, in-depth engagement of the relationship between Christianity and Islam, between Protestant Christianity and Eastern Orthodox Christianity. And Kuyper was a head of state, so wherever he went, he had privileged access to live typically with heads of state. I mean, he was invited as a dignitary and to be given access to whatever he wanted to see. And so this book is all about his reflections through his travels. Kuyper was very worldly wise. And actually, there's a modern day series that follows in the footsteps of Kuyper and has readings from his assessments. And Kuyper is, one of the things you're gonna find out is he is prophetic. Like, Kuyper says stuff that you're like, how did he know that? One of the things Kuyper says, which will give you an idea, and we'll wind it down here, we'll have some Q&A, is Kuyper says, in quite a shocking moment, he says, if you don't understand where modernism is going, let me tell you. If we could fast forward into the future, modernism's logic, and by that he means Western secularism, its logic is going to push to eventually erase distinctions between male and female. Kuyper wrote that over 100 years ago. The man was prophetic. He had a pulse of the cultural moment. He read it so deeply. This guy is editing newspapers about everything happening that he could see where things were going so far out, and he could recognize what's happening. And he has attempted to help us. When he came to America and he gave us the word worldview, he was trying to help us think about ourselves in a third person, because we are no longer going to be, you know, when your assumptions are the assumptions that everybody holds, you don't need to be aware of them. But if you're gonna step into a situation in which you're gonna have a conversation with somebody that holds none of your assumptions, you need to recognize your assumptions as your assumptions and know why you believe them. That's kind of apologetics 101. Kuyper knew that. And Kuyper wanted us to understand how to deal with our secular age. So I'm going to end with that, with a little picture of Kuyper in his later years. There he is walking with Joe towards the end of his life in Amsterdam, one of our Christian forebearers who I think still speaks to us today. Before we take Q&A, I just want to point out a couple resources, and then we'll do Q&A. Is that okay? A couple things. You say, where do I begin? I want to know about Kuyper. Okay. If you want a biography, all right, and that's what we did today is biography, there's not a better biography in English than this one by James Bratt, Abraham Kuyper, Modern Calvinist Christian Democrat. This is not hagiography, okay? This is not like everything Kuyper touched turned to gold and everything Kuyper did was great. You're going to read this, and you are going to be, as you should be, with any person you get to know well. Like, I know John Calvin really well. I'm a Calvin scholar, okay? When you get to know Calvin really well, your admiration is going to go through the roof, and then there's going to be things where you're like, oh my gosh, Calvin, really? You know, it's kind of like, becomes like your brother. You're like, well, the guy's got some insecurities here. You know, I mean, it's that kind of thing. Well, this is the same thing. Like, you're going to read about Kuyper, and you will be like gobsmacked by how amazing this person is. And then there'll be moments where you're like, eh, not your best moment, Kuyper. But it's the real deal, and it's an excellent, excellent overview of Kuyper. And it's not just about the details of his life. It goes into his contribution and weaves his contributions into the details of his life. So there's that. One of Kuyper, usually kind of like the introductory text into Kuyper, which has probably the most unfortunate title in the history of Christian books because people don't read it because of the title and it's misleading, but it's called Lectures on Calvinism. And when you hear that, you think like, oh, well, I'm not a Calvinist. I'm not going to read that. It's not about Calvinism. Maybe another way of saying this is Lectures on Thinking from a Worldview Shaped from the Reformation. And in this, Kuyper introduces worldview. He talks about how a Christian worldview should think about art, should think about science, should think about all the different aspects of life, how Christians think uniquely. And if you want an introduction to this or a compendium, this is a book that just came out. It's called Calvinism for a Secular Age, a 21st Century Reading of Abraham Kuyper's Lectures on Calvinism, or Stone Lectures. This was Calvin's Stone Lectures at Princeton. This is a companion, and here you have, like, for instance, where it talks about science, you have a scientist engaging with Kuyper's words on science and how it's still relevant, what he talked about in terms of a Christian worldview on science. And when Kuyper talks about art, you have a person that does art and all that stuff. So this is a great companion with these two, and this is oftentimes like the into Kuyper. And then finally, if you just can't get enough, the Abraham Kuyper Centennial Reader. This is also by James Bratt. This goes through several of Kuyper's speeches, and it gives these little, it's a reader, so it gives you little vignettes from different things Kuyper has done. In it, you have that inauguration speech that Kuyper gave at the Free University. In it, you have Kuyper's assessment of secularism, or what he called modernism. In it, you have so many different, I mean, it's probably got about 20 different readings on Kuyper, and this is also recommended. So there's some things to whet your appetite. I'm excited for the journey, and I'm happy to take any questions at this time.
Robert. This is fantastic. Thank you. I want to let everybody know that the dates for the rest of your talks are March 5th, which is next week, and then we're going to take a break. We'll have Hugh back, and then you're going to do two more weeks in a row, April 30th and May 7th.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, each one of these talks can kind of stand on their own, but if you can, it'd be great if you're able to follow the whole series. So yeah, there will be a little gap there between the talks.
So I want to let everybody know in the audience, if you have a question, come on up. You can grab the mic. If you're online, you can ask a question, and I will take turns between the questions. I'm going to start with a question from me. A couple of years ago, you did a fantastic series on C.S. Lewis, and it just kind of made sense. Like, everybody knows C.S. Lewis but doesn't know enough about him. But Abraham Kuyper is a less well-known figure. Out of all the dozens of theologians you could have done a talk on, or even Dutch theologians, why personally did you pick Kuyper?
Well, number one, Kuyper is one of my favorite theologians, okay? But number two, Kuyper has changed my life. Like, reading him has changed my life. When I actually have expertise in fashion theory, okay? And I have written a book called Fashion Theology, which talks about how theology engages fashion. Okay, and actually, you can be praying, because actually in a month and a half, we're going to have a conference at Parsons, New York, and there's going to be several thinkers, many of them are Christian, and we're going to get together and talk about Christianity and fashion, right? Because if Jesus, if there's no square inch where Jesus, who is Lord of all, does not say mine, what does that mean about the square inch or the inches that we wear, right? But where did I get this inspiration? I got this inspiration because I needed to write a sample for a PhD application, and I thought, well, I'll read some more Kuiper. And I read a speech from 1867, how long ago was that, 150 years ago? In which Kuiper is talking about the relationship between fashion and secularization. Now, the only person that has spoken with that kind of clarity about the subject is a guy named Charles Taylor, who is arguably one of the top public intellectuals in the history of the world. And Charles Taylor, in his A Secular Age, has lots to say about fashion and secularization. But you have to fast forward about 130 years before somebody else picks up that subject. When I read this, I thought, my goodness, Christians were thinking this deeply about a cultural facet like fashion? You know? And so Kuiper opened that up to me. Kuiper has opened up the world of architecture. If you read any Christians on architecture, they're always going to go back to Kuiper. So Kuiper thought cosmically. He's not just a theologian that is going to get in. And this is why I don't like the lectures on Calvinism. When we think of Calvinism, we think of like debating who chose first, predestination, free will, right? Is it God? God choose me, I choose him. Like, this is actually not anything like that. That's more like you get very narrow and focused on a few issues of soteriology. Kuiper is like this. He's cosmic, and he connects the Christian faith to all kinds of subjects. So he has this way of reading him. It shapes your mind to integrating your Christian faith into any given subject. So that's one of the reasons. I mean, during the series, you're going to see more reasons, right? Like why I love Abraham Kuiper and why I'm drawn to him and why I feel like I really want us to understand him.
Just so everybody knows, we've got 13 minutes left. We've got a question from Mark Durham right there, who asks, where did his question go? Mark, it disappeared, but I'm going to wing it. Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead and ask it. It's your question.
Yeah, we have a little trouble. Sometimes they disappear offline. But my question was, did Darwinism prompt modernism into existence, or was modernism the cause of Darwinism?
That's a really good question. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's kind of a chicken or egg kind of thing. Modernism typically is a description of a period, right? And modernism is a period, oftentimes it's used to apply to like the kind of values, thoughts, styles that are kind of afoot during that period. Kuiper uses modernism in a more technical sense. Your question seems to be asking about modernism not just simply in terms of a style. For instance, minimalism in architecture is a modernist kind of style. But it's more talking about modernism in the sense of secularization. Is that right?
Yeah.
So the question is, what's the relationship between Darwin and secularization? Mm-hmm. And I would say that Darwin was one more reinforcing voice in secularization. Because Darwin, the real cash value of Darwin, his theories have been largely discredited even by modern Darwinists, you know, like his kind of simplistic understandings of evolution. But the cash value was Darwin gave modern people hope for believing that the universe exists apart from God. We don't need God for the equation. And that hope was part of one of the key planks in what we would call secularization, right? So, and of course, other voices that give us reason to believe that would then reinforce Darwin's own voice claiming that we don't need God in the equation to make sense of the world.
Okay.
It's a great question. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Bob.
Hi there. So I went to a Christian school, APU, to get my Azusa Pacific, if you guys know it, to get my bachelor's in biology. And while I was there, I was very blessed to have some amazing professors. But I know not all of them shared the same views. And a lot of the professors in theology had their own doubts. And I just wanted to know, in your experience with theologians and the higher academic thinkers in theology, what were the biggest areas of doubt for them?
And what if they didn't have doubt for them?
Yeah.
Well, that's a really interesting question. I really appreciate it. What's your name?
Tim.
Tim. Thanks, Tim. That's a fascinating question. Oh, man. I'll be honest with you. I think that most theologians, with all their academic expertise and, you know, dotting I's and crossing T's and how many angels on the head of a pin and all the kind of like slicing and dicing we do, I think that they're just like everybody else. And the theologians that I've seen, and I've seen some theologians deconvert. I've been around the game long enough to see people deconvert. And these are theologians deconvert. And what I've seen, and this is just what I've seen, Tim, is it comes down to the same reasons other people deconvert. It isn't an intellectual problem, it's an existential problem. And so, for instance, I can think of one person that deconverted because they went through a really hard time. A really difficult thing in their life came up, and they got extremely lonely, and they got extremely angry towards God. And then one day they decided to sleep with somebody that wasn't their spouse. And then when they were confronted with that, they decided to continue sleeping with somebody who wasn't their spouse. And as they continued to act a certain way, guess what happened to their theology? It kept adjusting so they could live the way they wanted to. And actually, Kuyper, bringing it back to Kuyper, Kuyper points out this. Kuyper doesn't just talk about worldview, like an intellectual apparatus. In Lectures on Calvinism, Kuyper talks about the world and life view. Because for Kuyper, you can't separate your belief system from your lifestyle. Or in the, as James says, you know, that you can't set, if you say you believe something, but you're not behaving that way in a way in line with that, you actually don't believe it. Or like Paul said in the text I preached today, you Corinthians say you're practicing the Lord's Supper, you're not doing the Lord's Supper, even though you might be looking like you're doing the Lord's Supper because you're not living what this entails. So, I mean, I would like to say that there's these intellectual blocks out there that people can't conquer, but the reality is that I think it really does come down to us in those moments. I mean, it's the problem of evil existentially that we all have to face. And the only solution to that, the problem of evil, is a deeper mystery, and that is the cross. The cross is the mystery that engulfs the mystery of evil. And only in the cross can we come face to face with a God who sits in the pain and says, I'm with you here. That's the only answer you can give. And it doesn't mean that it solves it. It just means that there is a way out, right? Yeah. Good question, Tim.
Robert, we have an online question from Tinny W. He says, did C.S. Lewis look into Kuyper's conversion when he converted?
I don't think Lewis knew much about Kuyper. And it's a really good question. I actually have never found anywhere where Lewis mentions Kuyper. And I don't think that he would have known much about Kuyper because Kuyper's works were not translated. They're just now getting translated. It's kind of an exciting time to be studying Kuyper and Herman Bovink, another one of Kuyper's colleagues, because all this stuff is getting translated all the time. There's only a few things that were translated back then. Now we have giant volumes that have just been, I mean, the complete works of Kuyper's public theology literally just got completed, okay? So I don't think, and that's been one of the problems is that in the English-speaking world, most of us don't speak Dutch. There's only about, you know, right now there's about, I think, 20 million Dutch speakers in the world, you know, so it's not really a language people learn. So, good question.
Okay, Robert, thanks so much for telling us about Kuyper today. I had heard of him, but I knew very little about him. I think we need more Kuypers raised up in the United States at this critical time that we are in. I really appreciated what you had to say, and also what you had to say about think critically as you read. When I recommend things to people, I say, if I agree 90% with it, I can recommend it to you. But go ahead and read it, even if you disagree a little bit, because you should think about eating the meat and spitting out the bones. And instead, we often throw the baby out with the bathwater if we find something we disagree with. So so I really appreciated that. We need to think about that in our churches, I think. But my question is actually related to the potato picker, who I was fascinated with. How do you spell her name? I didn't catch that.
It's P-I-E.
P-I-E.
T-J-A. Pietja.
T-J-A. Okay. And I'm sorry, I may have been thinking about the coffee I was drinking, but how did you say they got connected in the first place?
She was a member of Kuyper's church before he became a pastor. And when he became a pastor, she stopped attending and started studying the Bible and the Puritans with some other people that left. Uh-huh. And then he started meeting with her.
And he was wanted to meet with her. He was interested in me.
He wanted to meet with all the people that left.
Oh, okay. That's,
yes.
That's right.
That's right. Yeah. It's one of the most amazing, and there should be a movie about this.
Yes.
Like, it's one of the most amazing things, you know? And I mean, this is, by the way, I mean, I call myself Kuiperian. I'm 90%, right? Like, I like so much about what this guy teaches, right? But one of the things I love about Kuiper that I think that you have to teach people in seminaries is that the people that walk with Jesus, the simple people in your congregation, they are there to teach you. Doesn't matter if you're the pastor, you have a PhD, you have so much to learn from them. That's why in the New Testament, Paul says that you need to honor those who are older in the Lord. You need to spend time and you need to invite those people into your life because they're there to teach you virtues, teach you godliness. Kuiper, I don't know if it was the humility he got, right, from reading The Heir of Redcliffe, but Kuiper realized, for whatever reason, like, I need to learn. John Wesley was the same way. John Calvin was the same way. You look at the greats through church history, the people God really used, they had a humility to learn from the laity.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hi.
So you addressed about the prophetic word that Kuiper had about, you know, men and women, the identity, and you addressed about fashion. So what popped in my mind was Deuteronomy 22:5, and where it says that man shall not wear women's clothes and women shall not wear men's clothes, for it's an abomination to the Lord, and the Lord detests those who do so. And the reason why I know this is because my father has put that in my head all my life, over and over and over. And we're not going to go there, but I am so curious to know, what does Kuiper think about that verse? How would he interpret it?
It probably the same way your father interpreted it. I think that Kuiper, and I think what Deuteronomy is pointing to, is that the distinctions that God made in creation are things that we need to respect. So, you know, the Bible's really clear on this. There are two sexes, okay? There are two, and by the way, it's true. If you go down to the hospital and you just watch every baby that's born, you just go, okay, can I see the genitals? You're gonna find out there's a binary, whether it fits with contemporary gender ideology or not. And the Bible tells us that that is actually part of God's created order, this difference. And this is good. It's something we should celebrate. It's not something that we should try to get away from or erase. And so Kuiper would very much fit within viewing this distinction between men and women as a gift that we should cherish, not as some kind of problem to be solved or erased. And I mean, that's where I would be too. Like, I, you know, and that doesn't mean that, you know, once we get into the issue of contemporary gender issues, and there is gender dysphoria, there are people that are suffering, you know, how do we be compassionate? Those are real questions. We need to be compassionate, but we also need to recognize that there are also strong ideological movements afoot that are seeking to, oh my gosh, simply to erase something that is science. It's something that's just normal, every civilization has recognized, right?
Yes.
So, yeah. So, I mean, Kuiper would be right there with your father and me and Deuteronomy, so, yeah.
Well, I understand that genetically. My father was pushing on me fashion-wise, saying, you wear pants, that's men's clothes, abomination to the Lord. So I'm like, okay, I know what you're looking at. But that was then. How did he address that?
Yeah, that's good. Okay, well, let me just say something about that. The science clearly shows, and sex clearly shows, there's a difference between the sexes. Gender is something that is a social recognition of sexual difference. And the way in which that happens is as different as there are different cultures, right? Augustine recognizes this in On Christian Teaching, that differences between the sexes, which are part of creation, then get refracted through different cultures. And so Aquinas, for instance, says, all things being equal, you should recognize the kind of distinctions that societies recognize, which end up pointing to actual differences that God has put within creation. I fit with Aquinas on this. I think that's true. So some people want to see, they use the word gender as synonymous with sex. I don't think technically that's right. I think that gender is telling us something more than sex. It's telling us that there's a social way of recognizing sexual difference. But just because there's a social way that it gets refracted through something which is different in different socials doesn't mean, different societies, doesn't mean that what it's refracting is not based upon something that's true and real, which is there is a difference between male and female. And we think that we're so enlightened right now, but the reality is that societies have always recognized this. You read Augustine, you read Aquinas, you read people from thousands of years ago, and they're recognizing that societies recognize sexual difference in terms of clothing differently. That's not like some big genius aha that took place as soon as Judith Butler, you know, woke up and wrote something. Like, that, this has been around for centuries. So anyways, yeah, I don't know. There's some commentary on that. Thank you. Absolutely, I'd love to. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for those who have gone before us. We think of Hebrews, which tells us that we have a great cloud of witnesses who've gone before us and passed the baton to us. We thank you for the lives of people like Abraham Kuyper, who lived out not perfect lives, but faithful lives. And we ask, God, that we will draw inspiration from them, that we might live in this time, this period, with the challenges that we have to your glory. We pray in the name of our Savior, Jesus. Amen. Thank you so much.